Lorena Castillo stood alone, inside and to the right of the entrance portal in the 10-foot-high wall surrounding the buildings of Rancho Grande. She watched as Sam Heller made ready to ride out. Sam sat mounted up on Dusty. The steel dust had been well-groomed and well-tended in the Castillo stables while his master recovered. The mule's leg, once again holstered on Sam's right side, a 36 Navy Colt worn butt out tucked into the top of his pants on his left hip. Like his horse, his belongings had been secured and looked after during his stay. He carried his gear, now stowed to the saddle. Inside a pouch in one of his saddlebags lay his black book of circulars of the most wanted outlaws in the West. Topping things off, he covered his head with his battered but serviceable slouch hat, the same type worn by General Ulysses S. Grant and given by him to Sam as a gift. Sam was free to leave. None of the folk of Rancho Grande hindered his departure. In fact, he had the feeling his hosts were eager to see him go, for various reasons. Lorena stood just inside the main gate waiting for him as he rode out. Sam reined to a halt, doffing his hat in a courtly gesture.
1,000 thanks, Senora. I'm in your debt.
Indeed you are. And I expect your thanks to exceed many thousands.
I always pay my debts in full, for good or ill.
Your way is hard, hombre. I do not envy you. The Texans will hate you because you are a Yankee. The Mexicanos because you are a gringo. The Indians because you are a white man. Respectable folk will shun you as a killer. Outlaws will hate and fear you for the same reason. And if they really knew what you were about, none of them would rest until they killed you.
The way you tell it, I might as well lay down and die.
You had your chance to do that when you were shot, but you chose to live. Make the most of it. Find the guns, and we will split the reward.
I'll do my damnedest.
I trust you, gringo. You know why.
Or is it my honest face?
Hardly. I know what you are, and you know what I am. You need friends, allies. So do I. We are joined by self-interest. One false step for either of us, and we are through. Finito. We can use each other, gringo.
Well, that's the best offer I've had in a while.
You are a man. I am a woman.
I noticed.
More than anything else, I want to be free. Free of Rancho Grande, of House Castillo. To do that, I need to be rich. Do this for me, and you will not find me ungrateful. Betray me, and I will kill you myself.
Sam let that pass without comment.
If I need to contact you, how do I reach you?
I will get in touch with you. Gitano will be our go-between. I trust him with my life.
But can I trust him with mine?
As long as you are faithful to me. Any messages you have for me, give them to Gitano and he will pass them along. As he will relay any messages I have for you.
How do I find him?
He will find you. He will be near. Very near.
Not too near. I might take him for an enemy and shoot him by mistake.
If you do, make sure you kill him. The gypsy is a bad enemy.
I'd rather have him as a friend.
Keep your bargain with me, and he will serve you well.
Sam touched his hat brim in a parting salute.
Until we meet again, Senora.
He raised a hand in farewell.
Luck, gringo. And try not to get shot this time.
A U.S. Army cavalry column stood halted in the middle of Trail Street. It was made up of about 50 horse soldiers riding in tandem. The column faced west, its vanguard abreast of the Cattleman Hotel. The troops had done some hard riding. They'd been on patrol in the field night and day for 10 days. Horses and men alike were dirty, tired, hungry, and thirsty. The cavalrymen were not in the best of humors. A grueling, fruitless search for the raiders who'd sacked and burned Midvale had brought them to a hostile settlement. That's what Hangtown was to these Unionist troops, the stronghold of unreconstructed rebels. The war had officially ended in April 1865, with General Robert E. Lee signing the Articles of Surrender at Appomattox. But now, almost a year later, much of Texas was still in a state of siege. These cavalrymen from Fort Pardee were part of an army of occupation. Their mission was as much about suppressing any flare-up of secessionist rebellion as it was about curtailing Comanche, Kiowa, and Lipan Apache war parties. Townsfolk who crowded the boardwalks on both sides of Trail Street were surly, sullen, and unfriendly at best. The troops resented having to risk their lives fighting Indians on behalf of a population that until recently had made war on them, and given half a chance would do so again. Their bad mood was not improved by the thought of the mouth-watering nearness of mugs of frothy beer and tumblers of red whiskey available in the many saloons and bars lining the street, places now off limits to them since they were on duty. As for the folk of Hangtown, they found the Yankee soldiers about as welcome as skunks at a garden party. Captain Ted Harrison commanded the cavalry patrol. A decorated combat veteran of the war, he was in his late 20s, with curly blonde hair already thinning on top, bushy side whiskers, and a mustache. The unit's top non-com was Sergeant Carlton Oakes, a tough, leathery fighting soldier who'd been in the Army since the Mexican-American War. Wade Hutto, with Sheriff Barton in tow, went to the van of the column to palaver with Captain Harrison. Hutto's position was a delicate one. During the war, he'd been appointed chief administrator for the district. It was not a military, but a civilian post, exempting him from the victorious federal ban on ex-Confederate officers holding positions of authority during the occupation. Hutto was also the preeminent man in the county, the biggest landholder and richest magnate in Hangtree, and the one who had the most gunmen at his beck and call. But he lacked the will and the firepower to buck the United States Army. It served his interest to position himself as the middleman, the intercessor between federal troops and the folk of the county. He had to walk a fine line between placating the Yanks while maintaining the respect of the local citizenry. As for Barton, he was Hutto's man. Hutto had put him in as sheriff, and he'd do as Hutto told him. Hutto and Captain Harrison had had official dealings before. Hutto went out into the street where Harrison sat on his horse. Barton tagged along, hanging back a few paces behind Hutto.
Wade Hutto here, Captain.
The captain looked down from his mount.
Yes, I know you.
What brings you to Hangtree?
It was reported that a wagon load of dead white men was found on Tuesday on the trail west of town. Also that some other dead men were found at Mace's Ford around the same time.
Yes, that's true.
I want to see them.
That'll be difficult, Captain. They're all buried on Boot Hill.
Already? That seems a bit premature.
Been a spell of hot weather lately. We had to get them into the ground.
They gotta come out.
Hutto's face expressed puzzlement.
Not sure I get you, Captain.
We're going to dig them up.
When?
Now.
At nighttime?
This is Army business. I'm in a hurry. You didn't come out here on any pleasure trip.
Anything you say, Captain. We're cooperating.
A fight between two dogs would have drawn a crowd in Hangtown. Dark doings on Boot Hill at night proved to be a powerful attraction. It seemed that most of the townsfolk had come out to watch the show. A graveyard on the west edge of town was beyond the zone of light cast by the lamps and lanterns of the settlement. A waxing moon hung overhead, flooding the scene with silvery light. Thin clouds stretched streamer-like across the night sky. Torches lit up Boot Hill. Soldiers and townspeople gathered around the knoll on the north side of Hangtree Trail. The cavalrymen picketed their mounts on a grassy field off to one side at the base of the rise, out of the way. The troopers, not on grave-digging detail, were massed around the horses. They were off by themselves, isolated, separated from the townsfolk. A large number of the inhabitants had turned out to watch the cavalry dig up fresh graves. Outdoorsmen and town dwellers, cowboys and bankers, the gentry and the sporting element, respectable types and saddle tramps, gamblers and whores thronged the area. The saloons had largely been emptied of their clientele who'd come out to watch the proceedings. Many brought whiskey bottles with them and passed them around, adding a carnival-like air to the macabre setting. That was north of the trail out of town. The south side lay quiet, peaceful, and more or less unpeopled. The white-painted wooden church with its pointed steeple looked monumental in the moonlight, as if made of marble. Standing vigil on the front steps were the pastor and sexton of the church. The pastor was there to make sure that these devilish Yankees committed no sacrilege or blasphemies in the churchyard's hallowed ground. Let them do what they liked on Boot Hill. None of his parishioners were buried there, only outlaws and the indigent. The sexton, a club-footed, white-haired man who served as handyman and gravedigger, was charged with guarding against drunks and whores sneaking into church grounds to practice their indignities and indecencies. On the other side of the trail, the soldiers grouped with the horses smoked, chatted, and stretched their legs. Captain Harrison turned to his sergeant.
Keep the men together, Sergeant Oakes. No wandering off.
Yes, sir. Listen up, men. I know most of you would like nothing better than to have a drink, a woman, or both. Any man fool enough to try is more than likely to wind up dead before getting a dozen paces away. These Rebs will do you in with a smile, and their whores would knife you in the back for loose change.
One of a group of whores standing nearby struck a pose.
Everybody knows you bluebellies ain't got two pennies to knock together in your pockets. You drink up all your pay. You ain't telling them, Madge.
A cavalryman nudged his buddy.
Now she's got your number, Rourke.
And yours too, Bill.
Hearing the byplay, Wade Hutto frowned, turning to the sheriff.
Put a cork in that kind of nonsense. We don't want this turning into more of a circus than it already is.
Okay, Wade.
Barton passed the word to Smalls. The deputy went over to the whores. Madge, defiant, stood facing him with her hands on her hips. She had a mop of orange-red hair, a horse face, and a flat-chested, long-legged body with knobby elbows and knees.
Well, looky here, if it ain't the little deputy.
A pipe down, y'all.
Says who?
The sheriff. You try and act like ladies unless you feel like cooling your round heels in the calaboose.
If I do that, how's the sheriff gonna collect his cut?
You keep talking like that, Madge, you're gonna get your bony ass run out of town.
You ain't man enough to do it.
Another sporting girl in the group tried to mediate.
Oh, don't mind her, deputy. She's had too much to drink.
The hell I have. You mind your own business, Annie.
We'll see that she's well behaved.
I'd like to see you try.
Annie neatly clipped Madge behind the ear with a rawhide-wrapped sack pulled from a skirt pocket. Madge's eyes rolled up in her head, showing only the whites. She dropped like a puppet whose strings have all been clipped at once. Annie caught Madge under the arms and held her limp form upright.
Like I said, Deputy, Madge had a little bit too much to drink. We'll take her where she can sober up.
Nice work.
Be sure and tell the sheriff who he can count on.
I'll do that.
Captain Harrison and Sergeant Oakes stood with Hutto at the edge of an oversized mound of fresh dirt, unmarked by cross or headstone.
The men from the wagon are buried here.
You put them all in one mass grave?
What were we supposed to do? They're strangers. Nobody knew them from Adam. Nobody stepped up to claim them or pay for their burial. There's not enough money in Hangtree to rightly take care of the living, never mind the dead.
No? Looked like the saloons and whorehouses were doing a pretty solid business and we rode in.
Life goes on, Captain. With this hot spell, the main thing was to get them into the ground. Along with that bunch from the Ford, it was a heap of work.
Where are the ones from the Ford buried?
That mound over there by those bushes.
Hutto pointed to a second mound a half dozen paces away.
Terrible thing about Midvale. Those murdering savages slaughtering a defenseless town. Terrible. You pick up any sign of their trail?
We're working on it.
You reckon the same bunch of Comanches wrecked Flatbridge and killed these fellows?
I'm gonna find out.
The soldiers dug deep into the mass grave. Moonlight threw solid, dark shadows, chiseled, sharp-edged. Torchlight created the opposite effect, blending and blurring them. So each lone man of the detail cast the shadows of many men, a multitude. The entire group, working together, wove an intricate, ever-shifting web of light and dark across the forlorn summit of Boot Hill. Towering over all this was the cruciform pillar of the gallows tree.
Hell of a way to spend the night digging up dead men.
Be glad you're doing the digging and not the one being dug up.
Sergeant Oakes peered into the pit.
More work with your picks and shovels and less with your mouths. Unless you're looking for a boot of the tail.
As the soldiers neared their goal, they tied their kerchiefs over their noses and mouths.
I just hit something soft, and it ain't dirt.
Harrison gave Hutto a hard look.
No coffins?
Hutto held out his arms in an imploring gesture, hands palms up, as if mutely asking for divine compassion.
This is a poor town, Captain. We can't afford pine boxes for free for nigh on to 20 men. 10 here from the wagon and 7 more over there from the ford. We wrapped each man in a blanket for a shroud. Wouldn't be decent to throw them in and cover them with nothing but dirt. It was the least we could do.
The work continued carefully until the excavation uncovered an eerie heap of pod-like objects, like monstrous cocoons, nestled in the bosom of the earth, heaped one on top of the other.
Sergeant, have the men haul out the bodies and lay them out side by side so we can identify them.
All right, you heard the captain.
Oakes gave the orders to the detail, who began to comply. Guards had been sent around the top of Boot Hill to turn back curious civilians. A crowd of them, male and female, drunk and sober, milled around the perimeter, pushing, shoving, craning for a better look.
Ain't that just like a Yankee? Not content to confine their botheration to the living, they won't even let the dead be.
It ain't decent, I say.
Probably gonna melt down the corpse fat to make tallow candles. Grind the bones up and use them for fertilizer.
Them blue bellies would sell the gold teeth out of their mama's heads if they had a buyer.
The first 5 blanket-wrapped bodies hauled out of the pit were laid out in a row. Sergeant Oakes handed his torch to a trooper to hold. He covered his nose and mouth with a yellow kerchief, knotted at the back of his bull neck. Captain Harrison, too, had wrapped the lower half of his face with a yellow bandana. Oakes unwrapped the first cocooned corpse, peeling back a folded blanket to uncover the head. Harrison crouched down.
Hold the light closer so I can see the face.
The torchbearer moved to obey. The cadaver's flesh was gray-white, pale, bloodless, and raw-boned.
Stranger to me. Keep going, Sergeant. Try the next one.
Oakes unveiled the next in line, whose facial wounds were so disfiguring as to render his features unrecognizable. They moved to a third, the routine unvarying. Unwrap the blanket shroud, peel it back to expose the face, a torch thrust forward and down to illuminate the features.
Nope.
Came the fourth body.
I know him. It's Lieutenant Greer.
The captain straightened up, stepping back and away from the row of bodies and the pit.
That's enough. I found what I needed to know.
Hutto stood at Harrison's shoulder, not wanting to get any closer to the bodies.
What's it all about, Captain? Who's that?
A soldier. He was on a mission for the army.
Harrison indicated the masked dead.
They all were.
What mission?
Well, then who's buried over there in that second grave?
I can tell you that.
Harrison turned to look at the speaker, seeing a stranger.
What are you doing here? I gave orders that all civilians were to be kept out.
Begging the captain's pardon, but I passed him through the line.
Harrison's reaction was a mixture of outrage and astonishment.
You did? But why?
This gentleman has important information. Information best heard only by you in private, sir.
Oakes indicated with a tilt of his head, Hutto and Barton standing nearby. It was unorthodox, a direct violation of orders. But Harrison had not survived the war years without learning when to listen when a veteran non-com was trying to tell him something.
All right, we'll step over here.
Harrison, Oakes, and Sam moved off to the side a dozen paces, well out of earshot of Hutto, Barton, and the troops on the scene.
I know you well enough to know that you wouldn't deliberately disobey a direct order without good reason, Sergeant. That being the case, perhaps you'll enlighten me on who the devil this man is and what this infernal mystification is all about.
Glad to, sir. Captain Harrison, meet Major Sam Heller.
Major, eh?
Retired, officially.
That's Major Samuel T. Heller, sir. A hero of the Union Army.
Dawning comprehension showed on Harrison's face.
Heller? Not the officer whose counterattack broke the back of the Rebs' artillery at the Battle of Goleta?
The very same, sir. I know, I was there.
Oakes spoke with pardonable pride at having been a frontline veteran of the victorious Federals at the epical New Mexico battle with Confederate troops that was universally regarded as the Gettysburg of the West.
Yes, sir. As soon as I saw the major outside the perimeter giving me the high sign, I knew something was up, so I had him passed on through.
An honor to make your acquaintance, of course, Major, but I fail to see what bearing it has on the current situation.
This may help explain things, Captain.
Reaching into the inside breast pocket of his jacket, Sam took out a long, slim billfold bound in Moroccan leather and handed it to Harrison. Harrison opened it, noticing that it contained a folded piece of vellum paper. He unfolded the single-sheet document, holding it in both hands.
What's this? It's too blame dark for me to make it out.
Sam struck a wooden match.
Yeah, this'll shed some light on the subject.
The warrant's brief text identified the bearer as Samuel T. Heller, agent on special assignment. It instructed all relevant individuals in branches civilian and military of the government of the United States of America to render any and all such assistance in money, materiel, and personnel that the bearer should require to accomplish his mission for the document's issuing authority. It bore the handwritten signature of the President of the United States and was embossed with the official seal of state. It was also signed, sealed, and notarized by the Secretary of the War Department. Its lower left-hand corner was marked by what was unmistakably a dried bloodstain. Darkness returned as the charred ember of the stick match was hastily discarded by Sam as the flame flickered low and out.
Ah, where are my fingers? Hope you got all that, Captain. If not, I'll light another match.
No need. I'm a fast reader.
Harrison returned the document and wallet-like holder. Sam refolded the document, inserting it in its container inside the folder and putting it back inside his jacket pocket. This was the presidential warrant discovered by Lorena Castillo, which decided her on forging a secret alliance with Sam.
If that's not enough, a coded telegram to the commanding general of the Western District referring to me under my operative's name of Paul Pry will further confirm my identity.
I'll do it if I think circumstances render it necessary. I'm willing to accept your credentials for now, especially with Sergeant Oakes vouching for your identity.
This will take a few minutes to explain.
I'll make the time.
What I'm about to tell you is information I picked up working undercover, posing as a bounty hunter. There's nothing fake about the bounty hunting part. I kill wanted outlaws for money. But it's a good cover that gets me into lots of hard-to-get-into places on both sides of the law. You'd be surprised how many bounty killers are crooks, or maybe you wouldn't be. I wouldn't be telling you this if I didn't think you could keep a secret, Captain.
Thanks.
And I know Sergeant Oakes can keep his mouth shut. We worked together in the war. It would be useful for him to know the background if you have no objection.
Why not? Good sergeants always seem to have a way of finding out things anyway.
Only so we can serve our commanding officers better, sir.
Save that bull pucky for fertilizer, Sergeant.
Yes, sir.
During the last year of the war, I was assigned to the Secret Service as a member of Lafayette Baker's National Detective Bureau. I enjoyed some success as an undercover agent, which is why I got picked for this job. I don't have to tell you the strategic importance of Hangtree County to the entire Southwest. It's a critical junction of a number of militarily vital corridors. It's smack dab in the middle of the trails used by Indian war parties to raid from as far north as Kansas, south through Texas into Mexico. It's a two-way route, since it's also used by Mexican bandits and slavers to strike deep into our country. Hangtree sits on the trails used by stage and freight lines and westbound settlers, too. With the war over, the territory's more important than ever. And then there's the situation with Mexico. During our Civil War, French Emperor Napoleon III installed the Austrian Archduke Maximilian as ruler of Mexico. It was an outright violation of the Monroe Doctrine, prohibiting European powers from colonial ventures in this hemisphere. They got away with it because they could. With a secession to put down, Washington had to overlook the French-Austrian takeover of Mexico and the Juarista Revolution it produced. Now that the war's over, the administration's not minded to be so forbearing. Hangtree County is a hotbed of organized banditry and lawlessness. Comancheros selling guns and whiskey to hostile Indians, bandits and slave raiders up from Mexico, and gangs of homegrown bad men are all operating out of the breaks, using it as a base to found an outlaw empire. The president and the War Department have given me a roving commission as an undercover operative to suppress the most dangerous threats to the settlement and reconstruction of the territory. I plan to contact you at the fort, Captain, and establish my credentials, but things move too fast for me to work through proper channels. Through official sources, I already knew about the secret shipment of a wagon load of repeating rifles and ammunition from Fort Walters and Mineral Wells to Fort Pardee. It was up in Kinto, a robber's roost in the nation's Oklahoma territory, that I first heard rumors of a plan to hijack the guns. I found my first solid lead in Denton, Texas, from an outlaw on the Dodge who'd had too much to drink and ran his mouth when he was in his cups. The strike was set for somewhere in Hangtree County, but that's all I knew. Nothing about the who, how, or where. I was playing a lone hand and had no way to contact anyone at either fort. I rode here as fast as I could. I arrived about an hour too late. I stumbled into the ambush, but by luck, bad luck, I came down from the north and struck Mace's Ford. I didn't know that was where the outlaws jumped the gun wagon. Ordinarily, the convoy would have crossed Flatbridge and gone straight through Hangtown, west along the trail into the breaks. But the bridge was out, forcing the gun wagon to detour north, crossing Swift Creek at Mace's Ford. That's where bushwhackers massacred the escort and stole the wagon. They left behind some men to muddy the trail and erase their tracks. They loaded the dead guards on a flatbed wagon to take them and dump them in the hills. That's when I rode in. We had a slight disagreement. The horses harnessed to the flatbed wagon went wild and ran away during the shootout. I came out ahead, but not before catching a bullet in the left shoulder. Lost a lot of blood. I was lucky. A local rancher found me unconscious and took me in and patched me up.
Sam saw no need to go into detail here about his dealings at Rancho Grande.
I lost some days, though. Just got into Hangtown today. Since I got here, I managed to do some snooping that might pay off. So there's your answer, Captain. The bodies on the flatbed wagon, the ones you dug up, were the gun shipment guards.
I suspected as much. I knew it for sure when I found Lieutenant Greer among the dead. He'd been out to the fort several times before, running messages from Fort Walters. Bit stiff-necked, but he would have made a good officer once the shine on that military academy brass wore off.
I'm sorry.
They were all good men.
The others, the ones in the second mass grave, are the outlaws I killed at the ford. But the main gang got away with the guns. My guess is that they're the same bunch that hit Midvale.
Harrison nodded thoughtfully.
You don't seem surprised, Captain.
I've had my suspicions for a while. I was at Midvale. It didn't look like an Indian raid. It looked like the work of white men. Some, but not all, of the dead were burned up in the fire. Those I was able to examine had all been shot. Nothing much in that by itself. The Comanche stopped using arrows a long time ago, not when they can get guns. And there's plenty of renegades to sell firearms to them. The Midvale dead were shot, not once, but many times. Indians are sparing with bullets and powder because they're never sure where the next batch will come from. One shot from them is usually fatal. None of the dead have been scalped. That didn't look right either. A Comanche war party letting all those trophies go to waste? Not likely. Unfortunately, it rained after Midvale was sacked, wiping out the raiders' trail. We wasted a lot of time scouting around trying to pick up their tracks. While we were on a wild goose chase, the gun wagon got hit.
Seems more than a coincidence. Midvale coming right before a big arms shipment. The raid decoyed away troops who might otherwise have helped protect the guns.
That's how it worked out. We could have sent a detachment to meet the gun wagon at Hangtown and escort it to Fort Pardee. Then came Midvale. Instead, we sent out patrols all over the map. Some to Midvale to track the raiders and run them down. Others went north, east, and west to head off the war party if it went in any of those directions to protect the towns, ranches, and settlers in those areas.
Flatbridge was part of the plan, too. The arms shipment would have crossed the Swift and come through town. But the bridge was out, destroyed. That forced the gun wagon to detour north to Mace's Ford, where the ambushers were waiting for them.
You realize what this means. An outlaw gang operating on a military-like basis, with planning, organization, and numbers.
Why not? The West is full of ex-soldiers, Yanks and Rebs alike.
The question is, who's the brains behind it? The leader?
I think I know.
Well, who is it? Damn it, man, don't keep me hanging.
Brock Harper.
Harper?
Harrison's eyes widened, then narrowed, calculating, thoughtful.
I wouldn't put it past him. He's vicious enough. But the last I heard, Harper was in Mexico with a band of mercenaries, selling guns to Emperor Maximilian.
No, he pulled out a couple of months ago, after a failed effort to steal Maximilian's treasury from a bank vault guarded by crack French troops. He and what was left of his bunch ran north for their lives.
That's the first I've heard of it.
Well, I throw a wide loop, Captain. I've got a lot of contacts to draw on.
What ties Hopper into Midvale and the gunwagon job?
I had a few suspected persons, but no real leads as to the identity of the hidden hand behind the marauders. Not until tonight, a few hours ago, when a young, fast gun named Johnny Cross laid out Killer Kimbrough on the floor of the Golden Spur Saloon.
What of it?
Harper's a suspicious bird and trusts few men. But Kimbrough's been with him for years as his lieutenant. Kimbrough in Hangtown means that Harper can't be very far away. There's plenty of nervy, ruthless bandit chiefs, but few have a mind like Harper's. He's a brute, but don't let that fool you. He's a cunning devil, a thinker and a planner. He's absolutely unhindered by any shred of morality. Human life means no more to him than an insect's. Less if it gets between him and something he wants. My sources said he was back in the States, but I didn't know where or what he was up to. I do now. He and his outfit must be laid up in the breaks. Probably less than a day's ride outside of town.
The breaks covers a lot of ground. Hard country. An army could spend a fortnight combing it and still not find what it's looking for. Fort Pardee has hundreds of square miles of territory to protect, and at most about 150 cavalry troops it can put in the field at any one time.
This is your bailiwick, Captain. I've no intention of interfering.
Sam was being diplomatic. His commission gave him the authority to intervene if he thought it necessary, but he preferred to operate quietly behind the scenes if possible.
I don't want to tread on anyone's corns, particularly someone who probably outranked me during the war, but I have a suggestion or two if you're interested.
I'm open to good ideas from any and all quarters. Fire away.
The folk of Hangtree County you're assigned to protect have only slightly less use for Brock Harper and his bunch than they do for the United States Army.
No argument there.
On the other hand, they don't want to be killed in their beds by a pack of murdering outlaws either. Most of the menfolk were in the Confederate Army. They're used to bandits and Indian war parties. They're trail-wise, tough, and dead shots. Why not get them on your side, Captain?
That'd be a neat trick. But I'm a cavalry commander, not a magician.
Well, you've got something that beats anything in a conjurer's bag of tricks. Gold.
That's a joke. You know what a soldier's pay is like. A high binder like Hutto, or for that matter, Harper, has more cash on hand than all the soldiers in Fort Pardee combined.
I'm talking about officially, Captain. Even the tight-fisted politicians in Washington will open up their pocketbooks in a case like this. An army weapons shipment attacked by outlaws, its men killed and munitions plundered. Why, man, they'll call it insurrection and pay plenty to find and punish those who did it.
Possibly. But I have neither the authority nor the resources to post a reward.
I do. I carry a presidential warrant directing all federal civilian and military authorities to render whatever assistance I require, including financial. Send a wire or courier to the commanding general, Western District, stating that one Paul Pry requires the funds and they'll be made available in quick time.
Harrison stared at him.
You can do that?
That's why I'm here, Captain. I shouldn't come to Hangtown for my health.
Harrison's fingers stroked his chin.
If word gets out about stolen guns, it could start a panic.
It'll get out in any case. This way you make it work for you. Besides, these Texans don't scare easy.
Well, I'm not worried about them. I'm in a panic in Washington.
That'll help get the job done, too. Post a fat reward on the marauders who wiped out Midvale, and every man and boy in the county who can strap on a gun will be out in the breaks looking for raiders.
Could work, provided you can do what you say you can do.
Try it and find out. What have you got to lose? If you don't catch or kill the marauders, your military career will wind up right here on Boot Hill.
There's one consolation. If I'm ruined, I won't go down alone. I'll make sure you go along with me.
That's the spirit, Captain. And one more thing. Best keep Harper's name out of it for now. Publicly, at least. No sense tipping him off that we're onto him yet.
Sam had a few more ideas to go over with Captain Harrison. They spent some time scheming and planning, mapping out a campaign. Once they had it squared away, Sam took his leave.
I've still got a few things to do in town tonight. I'll be in touch.
Good luck. You'll need it.
We both will.
Harrison and Oakes watched Sam pass through the perimeter with an escort.
The Major ain't changed a bit. Still a ring-tailed hellbender.
The Dog Star Saloon buzzed with the kind of excitement associated with a gold rush. $10,000. That was the reward posted by the Army on the mystery gang of marauders that torched Midvale and stole the gun wagon. Wanted dead or alive. Johnny Cross and Luke Pettigrew occupied a side table in the saloon, a long, narrow, flat-roofed, one-story wooden shed a few blocks south of Trail Street. It was sited far enough west and away from the town jail for its patrons' peace of mind. The narrow end fronted a side street running north-south. A scarred wooden bar, black-brown with age, smoke, stains, and grime, ran parallel to one of the long walls. Johnny and Luke sat near the entrance where they could keep an eye on comings and goings. The place was murky, dimly lit by flickering lamps. At the rear, beyond a doorway with a dirty sheet hanging from a curtain rod to cover it, lay several cots where paying customers could have their way with one of three house doves. The saloon's clientele was mostly made up of local ranch hands, cowpunchers, tanners, skinners, hard-fisted, hard-headed, strongbacks and cowboys. A rough bunch, but more or less honest. That's why they hadn't much money. To hear them talk now, though, you'd think they'd already got their hands on a piece of that federal reward money. Gunslingers, outlaws, and tinhorns generally flocked to the fancier places on Trail Street. That's why Johnny and Luke were at the Dog Star. Anybody that came looking for them with trouble in mind would stand out. The duo sat in straight-backed, armless wooden chairs at a small, round-topped wooden table. A bottle of red whiskey and two wooden cups sat on the tabletop. Wooden cups, not glass tumblers. It cut down on the breakage. Luke held a wooden cup in both hands, staring at the liquid contained therein. Holding the cup to his lips, he tilted his head and tossed it back.
Ooh! Whoo! Ain't so bad once you get enough of it down.
Oh,
whoo! Kinda takes the sting out of my sore knee. What's left of it, where the stump chafes against the wooden leg. Yeah, not that I'm complaining, mind you.
Why not? You got plenty to complain about.
Luke looked surprised.
Are you kidding? Not too long ago, I was out a horse, a musket, and a wooden leg. Just about all my worldly goods. Now, I got me part of a string of horses, a mean sawed-off scattergun, some money in my pockets, I'm getting drunk, I got my wooden leg back, too. No, sir, I ain't belly aching. Fate's been right kind to me since you turned up, Johnny.
Sure. All you gotta worry about is stopping a bullet. You string with me, and there'll be plenty of lead slung at you.
Luke showed a slow, sly grin.
Oh, now who's belly aching?
Just stating the fact, Hoss.
Now, folks been shooting at me for the last 4 years. I'm used to it. Besides, I notice that most nearly everybody that slings lead at you winds up dead.
So far.
Well, let's keep it that way, huh?
Luke refilled his wooden cup.
Ready for another?
Johnny shook his head.
I'm fine.
Well, this'll make you feel even better.
Woo-hoo! Luke tossed back half a cup, his idea of moderation. Then waited for the spasms to subside and his eyes to refocus.
Oh, yeah, this stuff must be getting to me. These Dog Star whores is starting to look good.
You go with one of them and you'll have plenty to complain about in a week or two when your pecker falls off from the pox. Don't go getting too drunk. I don't want you shooting me by mistake in case we tangle with any of Kimbrough's friends.
Dead gun hawks got no friends.
Ain't it the truth?
Luke sat up straighter. Johnny was motionless except to look up from out of the tops of his eyes. Standing on the opposite side of the table was that red-headed gunman, Dan Oxblood. He was alone, a bottle of whiskey in his right hand. Johnny was aware that red was a left-handed draw.
Buy you a drink?
Well, that depends.
On what?
On whether you're fixing to even up for Kimbrough.
Red shook his head, grinning.
Ornery cuss, ain't you? Fella wants to be sociable, and you figure he's looking for a fight.
That ain't a bad way to figure in Hangtown.
A wide-awake young fella like you must have seen I wasn't siding Kimbrough tonight at the Golden Spur.
Now that you mention it, I do sort of recollect that that was the case. So?
Before you did for him, I was ready to quit Kimbrough anyhow. Never much cared for him at that, sour bastard. So,
You're welcome to pull up a chair and sit.
Much obliged.
Red hooked a booted foot around the leg of a spare chair against the wall and slid it across the floor to the table. He sat down, placing the bottle on the table.
What you boys drinking?
House whiskey.
Oh, that's too tough for me. Here, try some of this from my own private stock. Bottled in bond.
After you.
Trusting soul, ain't you?
Red pulled the cork, raised the bottle neck to his mouth, and up-tilted it, drinking long and deep. He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and slid the bottle over to Johnny, who took it.
Tasty.
Have another.
Don't mind if I do. Smooth.
I've been saving it in my saddlebags for a special occasion. Figured Kimbrough biting the dust qualifies as one.
Luke groped for the bottle.
Pass that red eye to me. I'd like a taste.
Red's eyes widened. Luke set the bottle down, its level noticeably diminished.
You're a drinking son of a gun, ain't you?
That is mighty fine liquor. Mighty fine.
Genuine Kentucky bourbon.
Red settled into his chair, leaning forward. His manner was now confidential, conspiratorial.
Fact is, I got a little matter of business I'd like to kick around with y'all.
Kick away.
Heard about that $10,000 reward?
I believe I did hear something about it.
Now, supposing a fella had a line on the possible whereabouts of those guns. Just supposing, mind you. Where do you think that would leave him?
I suppose that'd leave him in the way of being a rich man.
That's good figuring.
What I can't figure is why that fella wouldn't keep the secret to himself.
Red looked thoughtful.
The shortest distance between two points ain't necessarily a straight line in this wicked world.
You lost me. I never was any good at geometry.
How are you at trigonometry? Here's a problem. How can you trust a Yankee to keep his word? You'll blab the secret to that blue-belly captain, say, and what's to stop him from double-crossing you and keeping the reward money all to himself? Yanks generally being mean-minded money-grubbing types bent on hogging the world and stealing everything that ain't tied down.
How does a fella protect himself from that?
You're telling it, Hoss.
Possession. Possession is 9/10 of the law, so they say. If a fella had them firearms in his possession tucked away in a safe place where Billy Yank couldn't find them, why, then he'd surely have the whip hand. If the Yanks wouldn't play fair and the deal fell through, he'd still have the rifles and cartridges, which is just as good as money, if not better.
Sounds like that fella you're talking about is practically in the chips already. What's stopping him?
Well, there's a hitch.
There always is, somehow. And what's that?
Getting those guns is a mighty big job. Too big for one man. But a couple of men, good old boys, sons of the South, Texans who know how to shoot and don't mind pulling the trigger, could get the job done.
Johnny was silent. Red leaned forward.
Well, what do you say?
We still supposing, or are we getting down to brass tacks?
It's time for the nut cutting. Some might say I'm taking a long chance, but I've been watching you two, and I like your style.
I'm blushing like a schoolgirl.
All right, let's grab the hot iron. I know where the guns are, but between me and them stands a passel of bad hombres. Real baddens. Mean. But not so mean that a couple of smart, fast, tough fellows couldn't steal it away from them. Now, you want in or not?
I'm still listening. How about you, Luke?
I'm all ears.
This talking is thirsty work.
So's listening.
Luke reached for Red's bottle. He up-tilted it, holding the bottom parallel to the ceiling to extract the last few drops.
You killed the bottle.
What I want to know is who else we got to kill.
The long shadow of a man fell across them. Even Johnny's poker face betrayed a hint of surprise that the new arrival had been able to come on them unobserved, even by him. Red looked up at the stranger, then glanced down at his own holstered gun.
You're doing fine so far. Don't lose your head and make a fool play now.
Red kept both hands on the table in plain sight.
This game sounds kind of interesting, gents. Think I'll sit in and deal myself a hand.
Sam Heller pulled out a chair. Late Saturday afternoon found Johnny Cross leading a line of riders along a twisty trail in a rocky gorge of the breaks. The sun was behind the western hills, but the waning day was still hot. The line rode single file through a narrow, high-walled ravine. Johnny was lead with a strange group of unlikely allies, which was saying something considering some of the characters he'd been thrown together with during the course of a young but eventful life. A thorny friendship with Bloody Bill Anderson had taken him north into the border states to join up with William Clark Quantrill and such long riders as Frank and Jesse James, the Younger Brothers, Manning and Arch Clements. At war's end, with no amnesty for Quantrill's raiders, he rode the outlaw trail through the nations, ultimately winding up way down south in the bosky country of East Texas, siding with the likes of Cullen Baker, Bill Longley. Now, after long years of wandering, he'd come home, only to find himself teamed with the damnedest bunch of gun hawks and adventurers ever to set out on a wild quest to trade lead for gold.
What money will do.
With him were Luke Pettigrew, Dan Oxblood, Sam Heller, and five Texas vaqueros. The only one he trusted was Luke. Dan Oxblood was all easy amiability, but who knew what lay below the surface? The red-headed left-hand gun was an outlaw and renegade, a former member of Brock Harper's outfit who turned his coat and betrayed the Raiders' locale in hopes of collecting a piece of that $10,000 reward. He'd also been promised amnesty for his past deeds if his tip panned out. Still, there was no telling which way Red would jump until the moment of truth. Then there was that smiling stranger, Sam Heller, who horned his way into the deal. It was a case of either stringing along with him or killing him. Johnny had the feeling that Heller would be a hard man to kill. A most mysterious fellow, the Yank, but he brought a lot to the table. He could shoot, he had money and connections. Heller had paid for some of the firearms and explosives they were packing along on this trip. It was Heller who'd arranged with the Bluebelly Captain Harrison for Oxblood's provisional pardon in return for services rendered. It was useful to have a Yankee go-between to cut a deal with the Army, cutting down the chances of a double-cross when it came to the payout of the reward money to a couple of not-so-ex-rebels. But he was a bounty hunter, and a Yankee bounty hunter at that. He might get it into his head to collect on some of his erstwhile partners once the job was done.
At least no one wants me in this part of Texas.
There were other places in the West where the law would pay for his hide. Fewer partners meant bigger shares for the survivors. If it came to that, though, Johnny trusted in his wits and his guns to see him through the showdown. Heller had brought the vaqueros in, too, five riders from Rancho Grande, Sombro, Vasquez, Gitano, Chicory, and Latigo. Johnny would like to have known what lay behind that unusual coalition. Hangtree County folk generally kept to themselves and their families. Their lives consisted mostly of hard work and plenty of it, little time for socializing with their neighbors, even if they were of a mind to, which generally they weren't. The neighbor you shared a drink with today, you might find yourself shooting it out with tomorrow over water rights, grazing land, or even an unbranded calf. Anglos and Mexican-Americans mixed even less, each group sticking to their own kind as a matter of form, preference, and self-protection. But there was some contact between the two, especially for a native son and lifelong resident such as Johnny Cross. He knew Vasquez and Sombro by sight and repute. Gitano looked familiar. He'd seen him around. Chicory and Latigo were strangers to him. The hand had been dealt, and now there was nothing for it but to play it out to the last turn of the cards. Johnny set their course, taking the riders on a wide, far-ranging swing way out west, deep into the breaks, before heading back southeast toward Buffalo Hump on Anvil Flats. He rode point, followed in order by Sombro, Red, Sam Heller, Vasquez, Gitano, Latigo, Chicory, and Luke. Mixed in along the line were a couple of pack horses containing provisions, water, food, and munitions. By prior arrangement between Johnny and Luke, Luke brought up the rear. Knowing the country, he was less likely to get lost should he become separated from the others during the convoluted windings and turnings of their journey. Part of his job was to lay back from time to time and make sure that nobody was dogging their back trail. Also, of equal, if not greater, importance, Johnny wanted someone he could trust at his back, especially considering the bunch he was riding with. The file moved along at a slow, deliberate pace to keep the horses from kicking up dust that could be seen from a long way off. Brock Harper was sure to have the spotters posted at vantage points on the high ground overlooking the hideout in all directions. None of Harper's outfit had been seen, though time and again there'd been signs of their presence in the area. The signs played out as the intruders got deeper into the winding, roundabout course that Johnny picked to direct them undetected to the outfit's stronghold. For some time, the trail through the ravine had been widening enough to allow two riders abreast. Now Dan Oxblood urged his horse ahead, overtaking and passing Sombro to come alongside of Johnny Cross. He kept pace with Johnny as they proceeded.
If you wasn't supposed to be the expert on this country, I'd suspicion that you was lost. I rode the back trails around the hideout plenty of times, but I never set eyes on this one, no sir.
That's the idea, ain't it? Come by a way so that we ain't seen?
Hell, I'm lost. I saw the top of Buffalo Hump above the cliffs an hour or two ago, but I ain't seen hide nor hair of it since.
Which means the lookouts can't see us.
Spooked me a bit, that's all. I thought I knew this country. We could be in New Mexico for all I know.
Well, we ain't.
Oxblood took a swig of water from his canteen. He unknotted his bandana, folding it up into a square and poured water on it, wetting it. He mopped his forehead and the back of his neck before retying the bandana in place.
Hot.
Come sundown, it'll get so cold you think you were way up north.
I don't like being outnumbered by the Mexies.
You needed more guns. You said so yourself. It'll take more than you, me, and Luke to bust them rifles loose off of old Brock Harper.
I figured on rounding up the sidemen ourselves.
Keller figured different.
That's something else I don't cotton to. What's a damn Yankee doing siding with a bunch of Mexies?
Why don't you ask him?
Oh, you just put me off with some more of that fancy double talk.
He don't crack too much at that. He brung along a couple of good men, though. Good with a gun, that is.
Yeah? Who?
Sombro and Vasquez.
Which ones are they?
The one riding behind you is Sombro. Damn good tracker.
That old man? He don't look like much.
Johnny made a hand gesture indicating not assent, but rather acknowledging the fact that Oxblood had just spoken.
If he's that good, maybe he ought to be setting the trail instead of you.
Then you'd be saying he's leading us into an ambush.
I think you got me all figured out, don't you?
Maybe.
Well, you're right. I would say that. Reckon I'm just a contrary cuss. You said two were good with a gun.
Two that I know of. The others might be good, too. But I don't know them.
Well, who's the other one you know?
Vasquez, the one with the big hat and the big belly. He's Jefe de los Pistoleros, top gun for Rancho Grande. Big spread north of town.
He's fast.
Killed a lot of Comanches, more than a few Anglos who was prodding him. Him and Sombro have been riding for Rancho Grande going back to when I was a kid. Gitano, the one with the gold ring in his ear, he's been with him for some years too.
Red licked dry, sun-cracked lips.
Reckon that ring is real gold?
If you're thinking of taking it, I hear he's a wizard with a blade.
Bah. Billy Yank, five Mexies. Trust any of them?
Hell, Red, I don't trust you.
Well, now you went and hurt my feelings.
How come you quit Harper?
Red looked cagey.
It's tricky.
Keep your confidences, then. You don't have to tell me a thing.
No, I don't mind. I don't want you to think I quit a man cold just to collect a price on his head.
But that's part of it.
Sure, but not all. During the war, I killed Yankees who was out to kill me, and none of us saw anything wrong with it. I'll go up against a man with a gun if he's got something I want.
That's the way of it.
Just between you and me. Kimbrough recruited me for Harper's Raiders. I'd heard of Harper before, who in our line hasn't. And I never worked with him or met him. I knew nothing of the Midvale deal, on that I give you my word. I hired on for the gun wagon job. Why not? Just because Robert E. Lee, bless him, signed a piece of paper at Appomattox don't mean I've had my fill of shooting Billy Yanks. Especially when they're hauling a wagon filled with good guns worth mucho dinero. They knew the risks when they took the job. They took their chances, same as me. They came out on the wrong end of things. Too bad. they'd have been smarter, more wide awake, or just plain luckier, it could have been me instead of them. We took the gun wagon to the Ghost Valley hideout. What I didn't know was what Harper planned next. He's already got a small arm and he's planning a bigger. He aims to do Hangtown the way he did Midvale. Go in shooting, gun down everybody except the women, girls, and children to be sold down to Mexico. Steal everything worth taking, money, jewels, watches, horses, cattle, guns. Burn down the town and leave no survivor. Killing unarmed men and women and children, that ain't for me. It ain't sporting.
Red looked puzzled, as if trying to work out a problem whose solution was just out of reach.
Kimberlo now, he was pure poison, clear through. Rattlesnake mean. He'd rather burn a man down than bed a pretty woman. That's how he took his pleasure. But Harper ain't built like that. He's cold as ice. When he talks about wiping down a town, he got no more feeling in him than a bookkeeper drawing a line through a ledger entry and striking out a bad debt. He sent Kimbro and me and some of the others into Hangtown to scout it out for him. Like I said, I already had me a belly full. When Kimbro braced you in the saloon, I saw my chance to shuck off the others and light out. Even though it meant walking out on a payday I had already earned for that day's work at the Ford.
Lucky you stuck around town long enough to hear about the reward being posted.
Luck is what we're gonna need to take those rifles away from Harper. That and plenty of firepower.
Sundown. Buffalo Hump towered above the badlands of Anvil Flats. It looked like its namesake, the rounded hump behind the back of a buffalo's neck. A mound several hundred feet high, it was topped by a rocky knob. Its fan-shaped lower slopes were covered with small trees, bushes, and weeds. Its upper slopes were jagged slabs and shelves of brown, gray, and black stone. Lookouts were posted high on the bald-domed mound. Roving bands of well-armed gunmen patrolled the area. Three outlaw riders came circling around the mound from the southwest, curving north, then east. They rode wide around the landform, swinging out into flat open ground to make an uninterrupted circuit without a lot of weaving and dodging around rock spurs and fans thrusting out from the mound. By so doing, they avoided the intricacies of the high hill's irregular base, scalloped and ruffled like a coastline with dry land coves and inlets. Hidden in its recesses on the northwest was a long, narrow draw, a cut shaped like an arrowhead. The narrow mouth and plenty of brush concealed it from view. Within it were nine deadly gunmen waiting for nightfall. V-shapes wheeled through the sky around the top of Buffalo Hump, black kites soaring and swooping in the darkling sky. Red Oxblood watched them circle.
Look at them turkey buzzards. They've come to the right place.
Luke nodded.
So have we.
Johnny Cross had led the group to the cleft in the rock. In the failing light, Sombro found signs only of unshod horses in the draw.
Mustangs come here, but no men.
In addition to his gun, Sombro had a wooden bow slung across his back and a quiver of arrows hanging at his side.
I found this draw when I was a kid, hunting. It's a good hiding place close to Ghost Valley.
Now we wait till dark.
Then we make our move, eh, Yank?
That's right.
Shadows pooled, thickening, spreading like a rising tide of black water. The horses munched on tall grass and low brush. The men chewed beef jerky and drank canteen water. They dared not light a campfire. The comforts of tobacco were forbidden them, too. Not only would a light as small as a match fire threaten them with discovery, but the smell of tobacco smoke could travel a long way to betray the presence of interlopers. The gunhawks checked their weapons and hardware. Sam Heller busied himself cutting varying lengths of fuse cord and rigging them to bundled sticks of dynamite. Johnny hunkered down beside him.
Hey, Yank.
Yeah?
Sam didn't look up from what he was doing, working as much by touch as sight in the deepening darkness.
That day back at Ford, when I was fixing to rob you, how come you didn't shoot me?
I don't know. Must have been your honest face.
And why'd you take my part against Hutto and the sheriff back at the Golden Spur?
Well, after you killed Kimbro, I figured you were a natural for a Harper hunting party.
Like this one?
That's right.
Remember, I never asked for no favors.
Nobody says you did.
And I ain't giving none, neither.
I don't expect you to. Just do your damn job.
I will.
Fine.
All right, then.
Vaguely dissatisfied, Johnny rose and started moving away, only to halt after a pace or two.
Something bothers me.
What?
I've been studying on it, but I ain't got you figured out yet.
When you do, let me know.
Johnny went away, sitting down beside Luke. After a while, Vasquez drifted over to where Sam was. He stood with his legs spread, thumbs hooked into the top of his gun belt. He had to reach under his sloping belly to find the leather band.
A gringo. There'll be much killing soon, no?
Yes.
That's good. I like killing gringos.
The real money's in getting those rifles away from Harper.
I like killing gringos better.
Sam glanced up.
What is Don Eduardo like?
Money. He wants the dollars. That is why we pistoleros of Rancho Grande are here.
Good.
But killing gringos makes it all the sweeter.